Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, November 19th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, New York Times opinion writer, or I should say opinion columnist, New York Times, co-host of the Unclear and Present Danger podcast, Jamel Bowie, will be here with us. And then, making her triumphant return to the Majority Report, Jamie Peck will be joining us, along with her co-host, Jorge, the podcast Everybody Loves Communism. Be joining us later in the program. Also on the program today, just moments ago, the House passed a $1.75 trillion Build Back Better bill, 220 to 213, one Democrat voting against because of the obscene tax cuts that are there under the guise of the state and local tax deduction. Meanwhile, Senate to vote on the national defense budget. And of course, they'll also eventually get that Build Back Better bill, and maybe they'll destroy it. Republicans attack nominated bank regulator as a commie because she has an accent. Also, the defense rests in the Arbery case. The jury in day four deliberation in the Rittenhouse case. Meanwhile, Oklahoma governor commutes Julius Jones' death penalty. Keeps him in life in prison for life without any parole. Still no pick on the Fed chair from Joe Biden. Meanwhile, the FDA authorizes boosters for all adults across the country. As Austria becomes the first country to impose a universal vaccine mandate. In India, Modi bows to massive protests, appeals the farm laws, excuse me, repeals the farm laws. And lastly, Apple to sell parts and tools, allowing for a right of repair on its phones and computers.
Thank you very much, Tim Apple.
All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Emma is out for, she's actually out for today and for Monday. Different reasons came up. All's well with her, but she will not be with us today or Monday. In the meantime, Matt and Bradley are here. And just wanted to, before we get into things, read this. Hey, all. Sam, you forgot to mention two guests that will be at the Boston show. Teacher Lauren and her fantastic carpenter husband, whose name also happens to be Sam. Can't wait to see you all, says Lauren. You know, and it occurred to me, I know they're coming from upstate New York. That's a bit of a haul. Do we have a sense? Do we know over the next couple of days? Send us an email if you think that you are coming from the furthest destination to the show. The show, of course, as you know, on the anniversary of January 16th. So it's on January 16th. And part of our big live tour.
The big live.
The big live. tour. January 16th, you can get tickets now at MajorityLive.com or MajorityReportLive.com, because I know how to work a URL, ladies and gentlemen. Check it out. We were planning on announcing some, who's going to be there, but we'll probably do it after Thanksgiving. So check that out. I should also say, apparently, like 2 days ago was the anniversary, the 11th anniversary of the hard launch of the show, and we missed the soft launch. We totally blew through that.
Well, since we missed the 10th, I feel like missing the 11th was probably to be expected.
We didn't miss the 10th.
Didn't we?
We knew it was happening. We just thought we were going to do a live show then.
Oh, okay.
We were going to do that 24-hour or the 12-hour live show, and then, you know, the pandemic hit. So this is what's happening on January 16th is, in many respects, the 10-year anniversary of the show, 11 and a half years into it. So you can check that out. But thank you for all the kind words on Twitter. Maybe we will do like a little bit of an anniversary thing at the big show, just to play that out. Yeah. We'll do it live or something. I don't know. The pictures, you know, that we had very little video at that time, and the set was not nearly as impressive as it is now.
No.
No. I mean, totally different set of paneling. Right now, there's hearings in the Senate, or I should say yesterday, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, Comptroller. This is a big bank regulator position. And apparently the banks are a little bit concerned about Biden's nominee, Saul Omarova. And she was born, I guess, in what was then the Soviet Union. And apparently, this has got people very scared. Here is Senator John Kennedy. Well, it's not the fact that she was born in the Soviet Union that's actually got them scared. It's that
maybe
she,
the type of person born from Soviet Union that they're worried about.
I think they're more worried that she just seems to, you know, believe that there should be some tight regulations on banks, period. I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, there's nothing particularly radical here about that. But they are attempting to paint her as a radical. And here is John Kennedy, Senator John Kennedy, from Louisiana, doing it in what I think you could probably call a ham-fisted way.
I don't mean any disrespect. I don't know whether to call you professor or comrade.
Senator.
Pause it. Did you hear that? Did you hear, like, I don't know if it was a senator or whoever was just like, oh my God, are you, like, that, oh my goodness, is the functional equivalent. You got to be fucking kidding. You know, what I would like her to say is like, wait, do you consider me your comrade? Just start from the beginning. I mean, it really is so shocking that it's like this childish.
I don't mean any disrespect. I don't know whether to call you professor or comrade.
Oh, my goodness. Senator.
Oh, my God.
I'm not a communist. I do not subscribe to that ideology. I could not choose where I was born. I do not remember joining any Facebook group that subscribes to that ideology. I would never knowingly join any such group. There is no record of me ever actually participating in any Marxist or communist discussions of any kind. My family suffered under the communist regime. I grew up without knowing half of my family. My grandmother herself escaped death twice under the Stalin regime. This is what seared in my mind. That's who I am. I remember that history. I came to this country. I'm proud to be an American. And this is why I'm here today, Senator. I'm here today because I'm ready for public service.
I mean, if anything is going to help her get past those people who don't want any type of regulations on banks to be executed, that's actually going to help. I mean, you know, that is just so ridiculous. Now, one can only imagine how many of those people who were so concerned about the new Cold War that we have, I'm sure they are screaming from the rooftops now about how repulsive what Senator Kennedy did. That is just impressive. Like, I mean, who is it? Like, what four old people is that for?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's like also, I mean, let's make it a political liability to have a structural understanding of capitalism. Like it's the 1940s or 30s again.
Well, I mean, also, she has an accent. So, folks, today's episode sponsored by SunsetLakeCBD.com. Oh, I forgot the sign again. Darn it. Here it is. In anticipation of Black Friday, Sunset Lake CBD contacted us and was like, we want to figure out how we can donate a portion of our sales over the next couple of weeks to a good organization. And one of my personal favorite charities is Give Directly. They give money directly to people living in extreme poverty and basically trust people to know where the most efficient place for them to expend these funds are. All the academic research shows that this is the most effective way of fighting extreme poverty. Anyways, so SunsetLakeCBD.com and the Majority Report teaming up to turn that incredibly consumerist Black Friday into a fundraising opportunity for Give Directly. And here's how it works. If you visit SunsetLakeCBD.com starting November 22nd, so that's over this weekend, right? That's, what is that? Is that Monday or Sunday? 21st, Monday. Starting Monday, all CBD products will be between 30 and 60% off. 30 to 60% off. Orders over $100 will receive a free jar of their delicious CBD gummies. Be careful with those. Be careful with those. That's a $40 value. It's for free. You don't need a promo code. All the products are going to be discounted on the website. Talked about these guys, this company, both in terms of their business and their agricultural product practices. And the tincture basically allows me to get to sleep without having to take that Ambien that destroyed my brain. But the smokables, the fudge, the coffee, great gifts. Hand cream and the salve. So Sunset Lake CBD will donate 10% of sales to givedirectly.org. Like I say, this is an international anti-poverty organization. It sends cash directly to people living in extreme poverty to allow them to choose themselves how to spend the money with a certain amount of dignity and in a way that makes most sense for them. And here's what we're going to do at the Majority Report. We're going to match that 10% donation. So they do $100,000 worth of sales over at SunsetLakeCBD.com, and I don't know how much they do. We're going to give $10,000 and match their $10,000. SunsetLakeCBD.com, as you know, a majority employee-owned business. They have donated over $16,000 this year to anti-drug war organizations, to animal shelters, union strike funds, conservation efforts, food shelves, and refugee resettlement organizations. Again, visit SunsetLakeCBD.com. Take advantage of these discounts and help Majority Report raise money for a great organization. The sale ends December 1st, so there's going to be about 9 days starting on Monday the 22nd. Also, Emma's going to be sad she missed this one. Give a gift that keeps on giving. this Hanukkah or Christmas or Kwanzaa or just, I don't know, Equinox or a New Year's gift, somebody's birthday. It's the Hello Tushy bidet. It's a great gift because if people are bidet curious, they may not realize that the Hello Tushy bidet is, well, you're going to give it to them as a gift. You know, you're not going to tell them like it wasn't nearly as expensive as you thought, but it's super easy to install. You don't need any new plumbing. You don't need any electricity. You can do it in about 8 minutes. Hello Tushy bidet cleans your butt in a far more efficient and frankly civilized way than wiping. It cuts toilet paper use down by 80%. You wash your bum with a fresh water. You just spray and then you pat dry. The complete Tushy system they have turns your restroom into the best room, as they like to say, with the Tushy bidet attachment. You got the ottoman. They have a toilet brush, the Tushy stand and tissues. Join the millions of happy butts falling in love with Hello Tushy. Folks, honestly, you want to change your life and do so without having to expend an enormous amount of money? This is the way. I mean, most of us, every day, it really is life-changing. Give the gift of a clean bum to yourself or to your loved ones this holiday season. Get a 10% off plus free shipping right now at HelloTushy.com/majority. That's HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off and free shipping. And don't forget to tag HelloTushy on social to celebrate your clean bum. Why wouldn't you celebrate it? All right. Want to take just a moment so we can have a period of time between the bidet and our guest. Want to bring on to the program New York Times opinion columnist and co-host of the Unclear and Present Danger podcast, Jamel Bowie. Welcome to the program, Jamel.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I haven't listened to your new podcast yet, but it sounds awesome because I got to say that like those type of movies, huge sort of a soft spot for me back in the day. They were all like UHF style movies before we had, and that's sort of my thing, I gotta say.
No, I mean, we're both, me and John Gans, who is my co-host, we're both interested in the movies and we like them sincerely, but it's also the case that just in terms of trying to find an audience, sort of pitching for this particular genre of film, which has a lot of fans and people think of them very, with a lot of sentiment, was a strategic choice.
Is it exclusively from the 90s or are they, okay. So just from the 90s and how would you call them? International thrillers?
We think of it as sort of political and military thrillers, and we're thinking kind of broadly here. And so most of them are directly related to kind of international relations. So the first episode is Hunt for Red October. We have the Patriot Games episode. Our next episode is Clear and Present Danger. And then we'll kind of go back to the beginning of the decade and kind of move chronologically. We intend to do movies like Crimson Tide and Ronin and The Siege and so on and so forth. But there's also a lot of
people
movies.
People know my Ronin. Like I've talked about Ronin. I like the Frankenheimer's car chase stuff, but you can't go back and do the French Connection.
So we're gonna the 90s. That's the hard limit. But within that, there's a lot of different stuff you can do that kind of broadly touches on the theme. So GoldenEye, I think, touches on the theme. A movie like Falling Down, starring Michael Douglas, touches on the theme. So there's room for maneuvering in there, but the main idea is that we're going to cover these movies with an eye towards really trying to think through the politics of the 90s and kind of maybe historicize the decade for listeners.
All right. Well, if you ever go out of the 90s, start with like 3 Days of the Condor, because that's also another one. All right. Let's move on to the big news, and I want to work backwards, from today. The Build Back Better bill passed last night, or no, this morning, I should say. Last night, Kevin McCarthy did, I am not quite clear on what he did. What is your, he spoke all night, and it seemed to me, I don't know if he thought like, oh, they're going to have to take the vote at like 2 a.m. and I'm going to get, you know, it's going to make it seem like the Democrats didn't want people to know that they passed this, or if it was more like, I need to shore up my chances of becoming majority leader when the Republicans take over in the midterms. What was your sense of like what McCarthy was doing? And then we'll talk about the bill itself.
I think you had it with that latter point. I think McCarthy just wants to, it's not a given that McCarthy's going to be Speaker of the House next year if Republicans win the House. And so I think he's trying to present himself as someone who's going to stand up against Democrats and resist Democrats as much as possible. I want to make the quick point that, you know, McCarthy could speak for so long because House leadership, even if they're only allocated a minute to speak, have basically unlimited speaking privileges. And so we kind of took advantage of that to speak for 8 hours and 30 minutes or so. And then he stopped. Like, he obviously couldn't go on for much longer, so he stopped. And I think that maybe gives us an illustration what the return to the talking filibuster in the Senate might look like if it ever happens, right? That you can delay a vote as long as you want, as long as you're able to keep the floor. But once you're no longer able to keep the floor, that's the end of the ball game.
And we should say, I mean, relative to people in the Senate, you know, we just played a clip of Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana. And I feel like he could probably, if he had to stand up and talk, I feel like maybe 45 minutes.
Right. Maybe 45 yeah, minutes. It's not clear to me that anyone really has the or too many people have the stamina to talk for 12 hours or 16 hours or 24 hours to delay a vote versus the current system now where you can just send an email and say that you want to invoke cloture or you want to require a cloture vote.
And I should say, like, I think that element of the conversation could get more. This could become more relevant once we get past the Build Back Better bill, the debt ceiling, the budget. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure to reform the filibuster, at least in the context of voting. And you wrote a little bit about that this past week, but before we get to that, let's just talk about the Build Back Better bill. The biggest expenditure, as far as I can tell, or one of the biggest expenditures in the bill, is not universal pre-K. It is not childcare. It's not the tax credit. It is the expansion of the limit on what you can deduct from your taxes in the state and local taxes. This was the only decent thing, as far as I could tell, in terms of like the Trump tax bill, was to basically say, like, you know, there was some talk that this is going to put pressure on some states, California, New York, New Jersey, to raise their taxes or to drop their taxes and cut services. But I don't think that's borne out, frankly. And it turns out that super wealthy people can afford to pay their taxes and don't want to move to some other state because they have to pay taxes. Give me your sense of like how relevant that is within the context of the bill. I get a sense of what it tells us about what's wrong with our politics, but just your sense on that.
Yeah. I mean, it's clearly there to get the votes of a handful of conservative Democrats, especially conservative Democrats in New Jersey and the states where this is most relevant. To get their votes and get them to sign on. It's also clear that in the Senate, which now that this bill is passed, it's going to go to the Senate, and the Senate is going to have its hands on it, that powerful Senate Democrats like Bernie Sanders are very unhappy with the expansion of the SALT deduction. So my sense is that this may end up being a real area of contention, and I would hope, I mean, my personal preference here is for that deduction, if not to be removed entirely, which is probably not going to happen for these political reasons, but at least sort of like scale down quite a bit before it goes back to the House, before it goes for the final conference vote on in both chambers. That would be my preference. But it is, I mean, it is, it does speak to, I think, one of the challenges Democrats have, which is their coalition now includes a whole bunch of affluent suburbanites. And this is the kind of thing that affluent suburbanites, it's the kind of thing that they like. Even if it is sort of, I think, antithetical to a big tax cut for rich people who own like multiple homes, right? Like is antithetical to what the Democratic Party is supposed to stand for. But the fact that it includes the party coalition now includes all of these affluent suburbanites and their representatives kind of makes it a challenge, makes it a struggle. We'll see if those, you know, those conservative Democrats are basically willing to compromise on their tax cuts to get a big spending priority for the president through.
I mean, does Joe Manchin care about it? I mean, I guess like this is like, it seems to me, I mean, I find it just grotesque, frankly, that, you know, this, it just seems so like miserly and greedy. I mean, it really just does. And, yeah. And you know that Gottheimer just has, I don't know, 20 or 30 donors in his district who are at whatever you reverse engineer, whatever, you know, it takes for them to be paying $80,000 in state and local taxes, the reverse engineer at whatever they're making annually, I don't know, $600,000-$700,000 a year, who knows what it is. It just seems, but in the long and short of it, you know, I'd like to see us, you know, go back and institute the billionaires tax and do a wealth tax and just across the board tax raises. You know, I don't care about the specific deduction in and of itself. If the package was bigger, I also, it seems to me, would be a fair trade. But does Joe Manchin care about that? That seems to be the problem. Like if this was a sop to Joe Manchin and he was going to sign on to at least the 1.75, which again, a big, you know, a significant chunk of that 1.75 is just tax deduction, tax break for very targeted wealthy people. It seems to me that it would be okay, at least in terms of like, we're going to have to come back and raise taxes on people at one point anyways, just to keep them from having that much money.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if Joe Manchin cares about this particular tax cut, right? He does care about the attempted wealth taxes and billionaire taxes, I think for similarly sort of like venal reasons, his connection to kind of the donor class. But as far as like West Virginians go, right? So the most relevant part of the 2017 tax bill, the Trump tax bill, was that it doubled the standard deduction. And so for most of his constituents, that's the benefit. And there's not really anyone, the number of West Virginians who benefit from who would benefit from this change in the deduction, in the SALT deduction, has to be vanishingly small. Like it can't really matter that much because West Virginia is itself a low tax, low service state. So I don't know if he necessarily cares about this. If he does have like a top line number that he's not going to go over, let's say he's just not going to go over 1.75 trillion or 1.5 trillion. Reducing the SALT deduction would be the kind of thing that could like get you past that number without really taking an axe at any of the programs within the bill. But I feel like that's the big unanswered question as we go towards, as this goes towards the Senate, is like, what exactly do Manchin and Sinema, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, what do they want and what don't they want? It's unclear to me. The House seems to have produced a package that by itself, I think maybe could get past those two, but it's for my part totally unclear to me what they would prefer to see or what they would like to nix from the packages that exist.
It feels to me like Sinema she's gotten everything she didn't want out of the bill in terms of like you know, cheaper prescription drugs across the board and that Manchin just doesn't want the bill. But it also feels like he's sort of run out of, you know, sort of fake excuses with all of those analysts coming out the other day and saying this is not going to add to inflation. I mean, who does he pretend to listen to? You know, is it Larry Summers going to come around and say like, well, I'm personally explaining to Joe Manchin that he shouldn't. I mean, like, what does Joe Manchin say at this point? It feels like he's run out of, you know, maybe he can come up with another one. Like, I don't want any bills that have three B's in them. Like, we got to stop get away from these things that are so alliterative. Or what does he say?
I mean, I don't know. It's Manchin has been all over the place in a lot of ways, right? Like, first he said, or last month he said, I don't think we should work on a reconciliation bill this year. But just, I think, a couple days ago, he said, oh, we can work on a reconciliation bill this year. I mean, I think my read on Manchin so far is that there are substantive things he does not want to see, right? He wanted this bill to be much smaller than the original proposal. He is skeptical of things like paid leave, of kind of like unqualified benefits to ordinary people. But once you get past that stuff, once you've either been persuaded or you've made concessions, my sense is that he doesn't want to actually tank Biden's presidency. I don't think he necessarily has an interest in trying to, you know, make Biden's presidency the best thing it could be. But I don't think he wants to see Biden, you know, crash and burn, because that if he decides to run for reelection, that will harm his chances as well. And so at this point, I'm sure he'll make additional cuts. I'm sure Sinema will. But I kind of think they're both going to end up being votes for this package, especially, you know, you're seeing today how much positive press the House Democrats have gotten. The Democrats have gotten for passing the Build Back Better bill in the House. And I think that's going to influence their tactical decision of whether they're going to support a final package. I think that if it's late December, if it's right before Christmas, and Democrats have passed, you know, they passed a $1.8 trillion relief bill. They passed a $1 trillion infrastructure bill, and they passed a $1.5 trillion kind of social policy bill. That's a good record to have for a first year in office. And I think even Manchin and Sinema are going to want to be able to run on and tout that record going into next year and beyond.
So let's talk about that. And I want to sort of, like, you know, slide into a couple of the pieces that you've written in the past couple of weeks, both about structural racism and about, you have a theory as to, you know, one way in which we could deal with the voting restrictions that we're seeing across the country. I mean, so let's just start with that, with the voting, and then move into the structural racism piece. Right now, it looks like, just based upon what we know in terms of the changes to redistricting, that all things being equal, Republicans, under the plans that have been presented so far, coming out of, like, I don't know, like Ohio and in Wisconsin, they're trying to, I don't know how they could do it anymore in Wisconsin, frankly, but and in Texas and in North Carolina, maybe I'm missing a couple of states. Republicans have already picked up, based upon the votes from 2020, they've already picked up the 5 seats or so swing that they need at this point. And which is, you know, seems a little problematic that they've already taken control of the House without anybody casting changing a vote. The polling numbers for the Democrats right now really stinks. Martin Longman, who's Washington Monthly, I don't know if he wrote this piece at the Washington Monthly, but basically said, like, just wrote a piece that basically says, like, there's a real problem, that the polling shows this. And then I got another piece, there's a lot of evidence that passing these bills one way or another, regardless of what their size would be, doesn't necessarily end up benefiting a politician. It's the absence of their, you know, not passing anything is helpful, but the actual act of passing it in of itself doesn't. So where are we in terms of, like, how messed up our democracy, you know, even our democracy is?
I mean, this is, it's sort of inherent in the fact that we do districts by geography, right? We draw borders over discrete geographical areas and assign representation to those areas. Inherent in that is just going to be shenanigans. There's sort of no way to avoid it, right? The term gerrymandering was coined in the 19th century, very early on. It's just part of the game. And so even if the Republican Party in this moment weren't, you know, radicalizing itself against electoral democracy, even if things were a bit more calm and chill in American politics than they are now, you'd still have this basic issue of the politicians essentially being able to, I mean, this is a cliche, but choose their voters and sort of use the drawing of boundaries to win political victories that they couldn't win or wouldn't necessarily win by winning votes. And I think when you combine all of that with, you know, with the fact that we know that incumbents have a huge advantage running for re-election, we know that elections are very expensive and to require tons of money, which kind of locks out lots of different kinds of people from running. When you combine that with all of these structural factors that kind of impose a level of stasis on American politics, I think what you end up having is a situation like the one we have now, where once Republicans are able to do this, they might be locked into power in the House for the next 10 years, right? I don't think it's going to be permanent, but 10 years is a long time for a party to be able to hold power, not on the basis of consistently winning the most votes, but simply on the basis of consistently having the right voters in the right places at the right times. I wrote this column that is about a clause of the Constitution that no one really talks about called the Guarantee Clause, which says that the United States shall guarantee to each state a Republican form of government. No one's ever really defined what this actually means, but there's a plausible reading of the clause that says that things like hyperpartisan gerrymandering, sort of a lot of the shenanigans you see on the state level with regards to voting, are themselves violations of the Guarantee Clause because they take away people's right to choose a government that represents them, take away sort of the basic assumption of majority rules, which underpins, I think, American democracy. And so, you know, the column doesn't go any further than that, than just saying there's this kind of weirdly powerful if neglected clause in the Constitution that you could use for all sorts of things. But if we're thinking practically, right, like one thing you could use it for if you're Congress is as justification for getting rid of single member districts, of boundary based representation, and imposing on the country, what political scientists call, multiple member districts. Where I live in Virginia, instead of Virginia having 13 separate districts, Virginia itself is just one big district, and there are 13 seats to fill. You use ranked choice voting. You use some system to that you vote and you fill those seats without anyone being able to control which voters are going to participate and where.
But isn't that, I mean, this is the dilemma, right? And with like basically an at-large type of situation, like you're talking about, that really benefits money in a way that, like a smaller district may not. Now, we may be past that at this point, where it's just like there's so much money that it's like a marginal difference. And the value of that is that you're not – that you everybody gets an equal vote. I mean, this is – and we should say to people like you say, gerrymandering's been around for a couple hundred years, but technology has allowed it in such a way that it is almost – qualitatively different because of the quantitative difference here. Like, and Wisconsin is just a perfect example where it's like Democrats win 53% of the vote for state senators or assemblymen, and yet they only have 35% of the seats. I mean, that's fairly obvious that it's problematic, because you're basically saying that for a certain cohort of people, their vote is just simply not worth what another person's vote is, and that's determined by the state house. So that we're at a qualitative thing, and I hope you're right that it's not permanent. 10 years out, I mean, I guess there could be enough changes and things could change, but that's a huge bar to have to win 60% of the vote to get 50% of the representation. That's nuts.
Right. I mean, I think that's where something like the Guarantee Clause comes in, because I think that plainly kind of like cuts against the idea of it being a Republican lowercase r government, sort of a fairly representative government. I wanted to say to this like money question, right? Sort of, I always see this as I think either any way you do that, any way you arrange, you know, how you elect representatives, it's going to involve, in the absence of, like, you know, radical changes to campaign finance and like, you know, constitutional changes of that, it's going to involve a lot of money. And the question isn't so much how much, but like where it's coming from, right? And so one, depending on where you are, this is the advantage, disadvantage. If you're running in like a singular district, there's going to be a lot of money flowing in. It's likely to be going to be a lot of money flowing in from sort of like the local, you know, oligarch is too strong of a word, but sort of like local rich guy class, the local class people who owns the car dealerships and the fast food franchises and so on and so forth. And there's not really going to be a countervailing force there. It's going to be difficult to build up the kind of countervailing force, as sort of like a clique of guys who they're, you know, with $20 million in assets who can donate $500,000 to a political campaign, which is enough to for their preferred candidate to if not run a competitive race and win outright. Whereas, and we see this right in statewide elections, we see this in national elections, simply enlarging the pool of potential donors makes it much easier for a candidate to represent, represent different kinds of groups, different kinds of people, to raise the money to compete. And I think that's an underrated thing, right? Like, it's possible to raise enough money to compete from small donors. We know this. We've seen it again and again and again. And enlarging the field of play, I think, plays to that benefit. It introduces something of a countervailing force.
All right, let's move on to another piece that you wrote recently. You know, I'm going to spare you. We'll probably play it later in the program. A clip from Jordan Peterson, who you may or may not be familiar with, but he was on some panel talking about racism. I thought it was just sort of like a perfect example of where we are with our politics in this country right now, even though he's from Canada, where he was bemoaning the idea of the existence of structural racism, and then was like air quoting just like the idea of racism. He said it's like individual instances of people who have a racial bias. And when we talk about anything that's like broader than that, that it's so imprecise that it's meaningless. There is a big push, it seems to me, right now in this country, and maybe it's actually, there's always a big push. It's just like at different times it comes up and it's just sort of dressed up differently, to deny the racism that is embedded and intertwined and sort of like stitched through our society in some way. And we see this in the context of, you know, critical race theory, people bemoaning it's being taught in elementary school. And I mean, I don't think it would be a bad thing if we did that. I just don't, frankly, I just don't think that, you know, some of these kids are going to pick up on it at that age. It's a little bit, you know, but you wrote a piece that also is in some ways a critique of some of the anti-racist, I don't know if I would call it doctrine or movement in this country, and that it's sort of missing the point. And in some ways, it's more aligned with what Jordan Peterson is saying, that we have that structural racism in the country is in many respects married to capitalism and is not about exclusively or even primarily about the disposition of individuals towards black people or people of color at large.
Right. I mean, I would say that my view is probably the exact opposite of Jordan Peterson's. I think you're right to see in there a critique of kind of the excessive focus on language, like this idea that if we can kind of, you know, cleanse our souls, then there will somehow be profound transformation in society, because I don't think that's the case. I think that the best way to understand what exactly racism is to think of it as sort of a part of kind of the structures, the institutions, whatever, that kind of form modern Western society that if capitalism needs inequality to work, if that's sort of part of the bundle of forces it needs to work, then racism is one of the ways in which our society has sort of determined who's going to be on what end of that inequality. It's the force that says who can be dispossessed, who can be expropriated, who can have differential rights of citizenship that allow them, that make them more vulnerable to those forces. And so, you know, someone like Jordan Peterson is like, well, this stuff doesn't even exist. I think it's nonsense. I think you can see it in law. I think you can see it in sort of the structure of the economy, that these forces very plainly exist, right? That at the turn of the 20th century, you know, most African Americans in the country were poor sharecroppers and were subject to kind of horrific levels of, you know, vigilante violence without any protection of law. And that this wasn't simply the product of people with mean thoughts in their hearts. It was for the specific reason of powerful landowners and planters needed a pliable low-wage labor force to enable production, right? And so that's a structural thing, right? Sort of that there is the owners of capital in that society in the post-Civil War, post-Reconstruction South needed a group of people to do low-wage labor. And American history, you know, our history of slavery, the aftermath of Reconstruction, the extent to which Black Americans were associated with servitude and subservience, racism provided basically the structure, the structural force for determining who was going to fill that role. And you can understand some of the labor struggles of that period and afterwards, as classes of white workers in the South, for example, realizing that they are in a uncomfortably close position to that and trying to struggle out of it. And it's out of sort of that struggle and out of, you know, some of those white workers recognizing that they're in a similar position with Black workers and kind of potential for interracial coalition, all these things. But that to my mind is the function racism serves. I think you can see that in the present, right? That, deindustrialization in the 70s and 80s, the rise of finance capitalism, the massive delocation of or dislocation rather of working people in the 80s and the early 90s creates like basically a big surplus population of people who cannot work. And one thing that, you know, racism as a structural force does is provide the context for shoving some of those people into the prison system, right? Sort of like incarcerating some number of those dislocated workers, disproportionately Black, disproportionately men, to deal with this problem of surplus population, surplus labor. So, you know, if you put me and Jordan Peterson on a spectrum here, I probably hold the exact opposite view of him. But I think, like I said, I think you're also right to sense sort of a critique of the heavily language-based, heavily internally focused, seminar anti-racism that seems to exist. Unlike some people, I don't think these things are sort of like world historical forces threatening the basis of Western civilization. I think they're mostly just kind of cringe. But having said that, I think that it is important for people to see that the basic problem of racism isn't that there isn't enough diversity. The basic problem of racism is that there is differential treatment and differential exposure to dispossession and expropriation that undergirds sort of like exploitative relationships, and that the goal ought to be sort of like ending that differential treatment and also ending those exploitative relationships. Like both things have to happen in tandem,
right,
for you to have like a solution to the problem of racism. So you both, right, you need to reform the criminal justice system, or fundamentally change it. And you need to provide a robust economy for working people. And like a robust social safety net and you know, democratic control of workplaces through unions. Like, you need both of those things.
And I hope you didn't. I wasn't unclear that I think there is a parallel, if not, you know, very similarly situated, when Jordan Peterson does not want to talk about structural racism and he wants to talk about the individual incidents. He is, I think, more closely aligned than one would think at first blush, or at least parts of it, with the people that in some way that you're not explicitly criticizing, I think, in your piece, or the approach that you're explicitly criticizing, which is he wants to reduce it down to a sort of a dispositional perspective exclusively and individualize it. Whereas, you know, I think the most, and I agree with you, I don't think it's the, I'm not too concerned about the class at Oberlin that is, you know, or the sensitivity training at Oberlin that is, you know, but that's reflective of also a narrow perspective. And I think one that is not as grounded. So armed with that perspective, that racism is extremely functional for the exploitive aspects of capitalism, right? I mean, it just sort of like, it's not completely discrete in terms of like, yes, wealthy people who are black can be subjected to racism, but the idea is that like you get one sort of a group of people that will, you know, broadly be, you know, available to be exploited without the same level of effort that would take to exploit other groups of people.
Right.
Does that necessarily follow, though, that the way that you, that by providing those material benefits and restructuring society, that racism is going to go away? You're still going to have, right? It seems to me, both the vestige of everything that was created dispositionally. And, you know, I think just, I mean, all of that, like that, almost like that culture of racism is going to exist without the sort of material foundations for a while, I would imagine.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. Because for my part, I kind of go both ways on this, right? Sort of like nothing ever really goes away, right? Like, I think this idea that, you know, time passes and things completely fade from view, it's not really the case. Things become, I mean, this is sort of the whole point of, you know, thinking dialectically, right? Like, things kind of become part of their successor. Things are transmitted through time. Even if far attenuated from their origins, you can still kind of see bits and pieces of them kind of survive through time. So I don't, you know, in that sense, I don't think racism is sort of like going to disappear. And obviously it's sort of like personal prejudice and these sorts of things are never going to go away. That stuff is just part of being human, but sort of this particular system of, you know, this idea of races, this particular system of things is a novel historical development. And I don't think if there's anything, if we ever get to a point past it, I don't think it's going to completely vanish from view. On the flip side, though, I mean, it's not for nothing, right, that whenever, like, after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, during the last years of Reconstruction, there's an active effort from landed elites in the South to kind of, like, generate racist attitudes amongst poor white Southerners, right? Like, that there is a recognition, at least from the people who have a stake in the persistence of racism, that that if you take your foot off the gas, who knows what's going to happen? And maybe that will begin, things will begin to erode of their own accord, or will begin to erode as the enforcement mechanisms are no longer in place. I think about a lot, right, is that you have this generation of Americans, you're born in the late 60s, early 70s, who in the South, especially, but around the country, attended integrated schools in large numbers for the first time and tend to have sort of much more racially liberal positions and beliefs than either their parents or in some cases their children who grew up in a bit more segregated world. You look at the integration of popular culture at the very least, you look at all these things and you can sort of see faintly that, that even just on the level of like cultural production, even just on the level of kind of, you know, without any real change to sort of like the fundamental, material relationships of society, you see like a weakening of racist ideas, just as people kind of like come in contact with each other and understand each other as like people, and not mediated by these ideologies, which makes me think, right, that, I don't know, this stuff could change much more quickly than we think.
Right.
You know, the rise of what we understand to be anti-Black racism in America happens relatively quickly, right? It's not a 100-year process. It's like a 50 or 60-year process, as a result of law and structure and all these things in colonial America. And so who's to say that it won't also unravel, just as quickly if we do have these sort of fundamental changes in the structure of society?
It would be interesting to find out.
Yeah. I mean, I personally don't think I'll live to see it, but who knows? Crazier things have happened.
Yeah. I think I have even less of a chance, based upon my age. Really interesting stuff. And, you know, we'll put links to those pieces, both the Madison, seeing something in the guarantee of a republic, and also on what structural racism really means, as well as the Unclear and Present Danger podcast. Jamel Bowie, really interesting stuff. I appreciate it, and hope to have you back on soon.
And thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right, folks, going to take we're not even going to take a break, are we? Why would we? We don't have to take any break. I just blow right through this stuff. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, welcoming back to the program, a triumphant return, and also, I guess, for the first time, are we good with the last names here?
Yep, we are good.
Okay, well, Jamie Peck, who I think we all know her last name, and Jorge Roca is here. Oh, there you go. There's Jamie. Dropping her first S-bomb.
Oh, God damn it. Where's it coming out of? Okay, great.
Okay, great. Hi.
Hello.
Hey, guys. There you go. All right.
What's up?
What's up?
Oh, my God. I went to the bathroom like one last time, and I knew this was going to happen.
Just one last time.
Well, you know, I get nervous sometimes, and I have to go a lot.
I understand. And guys, welcome to the show. Obviously, Jamie, you've been here. Jorge, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Just so you know, they pronounce Rocha.
Rocha. Sorry about that.
Well, he wasn't even sure if he was going to use his name. And
well,
that's why I didn't have it.
There was a lot of, I knew there's a lot of OPSEC.
Yeah, it was in the title. And then I'm like, oh, no, it shouldn't be in the title. And then I put it back in the title.
Well, so. I was telling Jamie, the reason why I decided to come out with my name is because I'm actually currently elected as co-chair of North Brooklyn DSA. So I can't help but not be public with my name now.
Ah, well, congratulations on the election. Jamie, how are you?
I'm good. It's been a minute, but
yeah.
I'm doing stuff. I'm still here making podcasts.
I've heard, and not only the Antifada, but now everybody loves communism.
That's right. So, I guess a little bit about the show. I first started it with my friend Aaron Thorpe, who people may know from the Trillbilly Workers Party, out of really a shared desire to read and learn more, more leftist history, more theory, trying to learn from the past, figure out how it informs our current day praxis, and create like an accessible resource on this stuff, because I feel like a lot of people, a lot of organizers especially, have imposter syndrome because they're like, I don't know enough. And everybody feels that way. So I'm like, you know what? Let's help them and ourselves, you know, learn more in a way that's hopefully fun. Aaron had to leave to deal with some personal issues. He might be back someday. I don't know.
Hopefully.
But yeah, I rebooted it with my friend Jorge, who I know from DSA, and we've worked on some cool political education stuff together in the past. We did a Capitol reading group. So despite never having done a podcast before, I knew that he was up to the task.
And is this audio only? You guys doing a video? Are you streaming? What's the deal?
So far, it's only audio, but stay tuned. Maybe we'll do video and streaming soon. We'll see.
Yeah, we want to make sure we can handle what we got going on before we go adding stuff to it.
I feel like there's an upgrade in Jamie's audio quality.
Jamie's audio does seem, yeah, it seems.
Oh, yeah? Well, I did get a new mixer, so what? That could be it.
All right, there you go. Thank and obviously still doing the Antifada.
I sure am. And people can still find that at patreon.com/theantifada or, you know, wherever you get your podcasts. We've had some cool episodes lately. What did I do last week? I did an episode with Aaron, actually, friend of the show, on the movie Born in Flames, which is a very cool feminist sci-fi, political movie from, when's it from, 1983, about this America that exists 10 years after this war of liberation that supposedly brought about social democracy. But, oh, wait, things are still kind of bad, especially for women and especially for queer Black women. So this movie sort of follows what happens there. So I discussed that with Aaron Thorpe, and that is out now for everyone to listen to.
Excellent. All right. Well, so, I mean, so give us a sense of just like what, in terms of the communism, the idea is just basically to help. How do you guys decide like what you're going, what topics are you going to do? Is it based on, I mean, are listeners sending in questions and saying, you know, can you deal with this? Is that like what the way you do it? Or are you just like, structure it? Like, how do you do your syllabus?
You know what? I'm going to let Jorge take this one because I was doing it in sort of a scattershot way before he came on. And now he's got big plans for how we're going to approach it.
Yeah. Thank you, Jamie. No, I mean, I think that's a really good question, Sam. And really what it is, it has to do with, you know, as the show's title says, everybody loves communism. You know, we have, that's our political perspective, but it's important to note that we are not going to just solely kind of constrain it solely on that. We want to discuss in terms of the development of socialism, communism, anarchism, and also even social democratic ideas, because it, we believe it's in terms of a much larger, greater struggle. But the way we kind of want to structure it, you know, right now we're kind of reading through Same Revolution by Lenin. But as we were reading it, something we realized, and before it was just like a political theory podcast, but it's become this also history podcast, is that while reading it, it became apparent that while trying to read it and explain it, there was things that were talked about in terms of the specific historical context that did not make sense unless you kind of understood that. So we kind of weaving in the history with the political theory. So after we're done the state and revolution, what we're planning on doing is, you know, take a break, but the break is to kind of take time to research, but kind of want to go in more of like a kind of a season model, which is kind of like ideas to, we're going to go back to say, you know, a few hundred years to around, like, say, the time of the Enlightenment, and kind of talk about, you know, you have these Enlightenment ideas in terms of how they exist in society. And we want to demonstrate, starting from there, is that from there, these ideas of socialism, you know, liberation, you know, communism, anarchism, from there, that is where, you know, from Enlightenment ballot, that is where they came from. And then, so we want to talk about with some of these utopian socialists, like, say, you know, Thomas More, or like, you know, Charles Fourier, for instance, or even like people like Rousseau, who in many ways was like a proto of like, you know, socialist ideas. So we want to go from that, but also concurrently talk about the histories occurring. Cause you know, something that is mentioned often is like, for instance, is like the French Revolution. We want to talk about that in our podcast, but people talk about the French Revolution, and also people talk about the Haitian Revolution. But what we want to do, for instance, is we want to talk about them as concurrent events back and forth, because they were.
Right.
So basically, it's a lot more work than I thought it was going to be at the beginning.
Well, I want to jump in there.
It's like intellectual history podcast, the intellectual history of communism on some respect.
But also of different struggles, Sam. Like, you know, we want to talk about, you know, how there are so an example would be we want to talk about, you know, peasant revolt. We want to talk about the levelers. We want to talk about, you know, the Luddites. And also, you know, labor union, things like that.
We're doing a series on the Paris Commune right now, not to interrupt you.
No, and like, you know, all of these things that, you know, it's like, you're right, it is an intellectual history podcast, but it's also history of, you know, workers.
History of class struggle and the history of, you know, trying to do the thing. See revolutions through history and how people have approached it in the past and what we can learn from that for the future.
Right. And also we would take seriously, you know, different reformers as well. We want to take very seriously on their own terms. People like, say, you know, Lenin argued with people like, you know, Edward Bernstein or like Karl Kautsky and demean them. But what we want to do is we want to take them seriously intellectually as what they were, because unless we do that, we cannot understand what are the things that, you know, what is it that made Lenin so mad? You know, why are people so upset about this? But also, you know, from there, you know, there are different approaches in terms of kind of going about it. And, you know, there are a lot of things we can learn from, not just, you know, ourselves as, you know, hosts, but also anyone listening.
I sympathize with how big the syllabus can kind of get out of hand, because I'm noticing that you did the three episodes on the Communist Manifesto, which is, I think, like, good, which is like a literary hangover is my show, where we do a lot of the Leather Stocking Tales with The Last of the Mohicans, right? But you can't talk about that without talking about the French and Indian War. So you end up doubling back, and then, okay, can I talk about the French and Indian War without talking about like Queen Anne and stuff like that? And it's like, oh crap, I'm going back and back in history. So I really sympathize with that. And I'm also noticing, like, the Communist Manifesto, you did three episodes. I think that probably takes as much as time to listen to read. But I also think, like, that's important, because I'm somebody who, I listen to people talk about basketball more than I watch actual basketball. And I think there's something people like about that. It's nice seeing other people take a pass at something that you want to interpret, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we are trying to figure out how to be more concise. I think if we did that many episodes per, 50 pages or whatever in the future, we'd be moving pretty slow.
Well, I mean, you got time.
It's true. It's true. I mean, hopefully.
I mean, that's the beauty of podcasts, is that there's no constraint in terms of how many you can put out. Let's turn there was a piece. I wonder if you saw this. I'm curious as to what your take is on it today. I was going to talk to Jamel about it. We just ran out of time. Did you see this piece by DeBoer, Freddie DeBoer?
No, but I'm very curious.
I think I glanced at it when I saw it, but I had mixed feelings based on what I saw. But I'll be honest, I did not read the full thing.
All right.
Can
well,
you summarize enough. It?
Well, just the title. You can summarize it. Freddie DeBoer wrote a piece in the New York Times.
Right.
I guess it was 3 days ago. Democratic socialists need to take a hard look in the mirror, arguing that there has not been enough. I guess he's arguing that, that democratic socialists don't realize that their program is not as popular as they think it is. Now, he also, I mean, he talks about obviously Bernie Sanders. He talks about India Walton, which I am a little bit skeptical that's what that came down, frankly. Yeah.
You
guys haven't read it, so it's not as relevant, but I'm a little bit skeptical and maybe, but not so much about the idea of whether the American public subscribes to the ideas of democratic socialism or not, but as to whether or not that for the vast majority of people who end up deciding elections, that they are that specific in why they vote, that it may or may not be that the American public subscribes to, you know, democratic socialist values or programs. I tend to think that there's a lot of evidence that they do, not necessarily as labeled by that, but in terms of the programs themselves. But I'm just not convinced that people vote largely on something like that.
I think I agree with that, Sam.
Yeah, or, you know, fail to vote, as the case may be.
Yeah, I don't know that it drives people out or not. I mean, I don't, you know, like, there was a lot of great things in that 1.2 whatever it was, $8 trillion COVID rescue bill. But I mean, like, for instance,
Republicans also did one of those, though.
Right.
They did not nearly as much of the material benefit went to like your average person. I mean, if you look at like the one in the beginning of, you know, the PPP and the bailout, you know, so much of that first COVID relief bill was, there was definitely benefits to people directly, but a huge portion of that was basically given to the Fed to back up corporate for corporate largesse.
Right.
And, you know, in terms of sheer dollars that hit people's pockets, I think there was significantly more in the one that passed, you know, and you know, at the beginning of this year. But you look at, I don't know, you look at like even the infrastructure bill, which I don't think is, you know, terribly, I mean, it's important, but I don't know that people are going to feel it in their pockets, or at least be able to recognize that's why they're feeling it in their pockets. But Joe Biden's approval ratings dropped, or the bill itself dropped dramatically after he signed it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't comment on the specifics of the infrastructure bill. I'm afraid I haven't been following it that closely, but I do think that Freddie DeBoer has a point in general. I think there is a position that a lot of DSA for Bernie types especially might take, that the working class is just this sleeping giant and we just need to awaken it by having a candidate saying the right things, advocating the right programs that would be, you know, the greatest good for all. And I think that is demonstrably not the case. We got owned and we keep getting owned, and we need to figure out how to organize in such a way that goes beyond mere persuasion and builds these kinds of lasting working class institutions that give people chances for a solidaristic experience, right? Because I think a lot of people, they saw Bernie's program and they were like, well, that all seems really great, but it's never going to happen. And I think part of that is, I mean, people are also heavily propagandized, beaten down. But like, solidarity has to be experienced to be believed in many cases. So I think we really need to start from the ground up with this kind of hyper-local organizing, and build a movement. I think it was a good try. You know, the Bernie campaign, it was a Hail Mary, and it almost worked. But I think it's going to take, unfortunately, a really long time to grow the kinds of roots that we need to even think about running someone for such a high office. I also think it's a little bit revealing slash concerning that a lot of the highest profile Democratic socialists have lost their races, whereas more of the low profile ones have won. I'm not sure what that says about media and spectacle, but I'm not sure if it's anything good. What do you think, Jorge?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you mentioned, the last part, is particularly important. You know, people focus a lot on with what happened with India Walton, and I agree with what you said, Sam, that it's not entirely that, you know, she identified and was a DSA candidate. There's a lot very complicated aspects in terms of why she lost in that mayoral race. But if you look at the rest of the New York State DSA races, for instance, we won pretty much all of them, and I think it's because people are resonating with a different vision of society and a different way how society should be going towards. But it's not so much kind of what you were saying before, and also what Jamie is saying about people are like, oh, trying to examine, oh, well, this person is socialist or this or that. It has more to do with like, well, what are things that are going to benefit me in a very real sense now? You know, this reminds me of, like, you know, it's kind of what you said about, because like the infrastructure bill, I agree that, you know, I, of course, have my criticisms of Biden and the Democrats, but, you know, there are some very real things that are good in terms of the infrastructure bill and also the COVID relief. You know, I think the, you know, family tax credit and like the permanent increase in food stamps is such a wonderful thing, in my opinion, because at the end of the day, I care about the real things that are improving people's lives. But, you know, a lot of that is just seems very obtuse and very abstract, and it just doesn't seem like an immediate impact. You know, it just reminds me, you know, and for us as organizers, something that's important to remember is like, what are things that are happening, helping people who are workers now? It reminds me of like, you know, the Black Panther Party, where, you know, there's, I don't remember the name, woman's name. It's just, it was a woman that was living in Oakland, and, you know, they were like asking like, why are you sending your children to this, you know, the food program, the breakfast food program to the Black Panthers had. And she said something along the lines of, well, I don't know what communism is, but it's feeding my children.
Right.
And like at the end of the day, you know, it, people don't really care. The vast majority of people, like, you know, us three, all everyone here, you know, Majority Report or people listening in a home, you know, most of us are, we're the weird ones that have like these really structured, illogical kind of formulations of like the way the, our world views and what have you. But most people are just trying to get by, and that's what they respond to. So that is our task, to try to reach them in that sense.
What is going on? I mean, obviously, you guys can't speak for the entire organization, but from your perspectives, like, what is the DSA prioritizing now? And has that, in the wake, in this period of, you know, sort of, I guess, post-Bernie, which has now been, you know, almost a year and a half plus, I guess. But what is, has the DSA changed its priorities in either way? What are they, and is there a timeline? Like, I mean, is there some notion of like, we're going to, for the next couple of years, we're doing this, and with the hopes of achieving that, and like, what's the plan?
Yeah, so great you asked that, Sam, because we, this year at the national convention, we passed a platform, a national platform for DSA, in terms of, you could, there's a long list of, you can think of many issues in terms of whether it be race, whether it be labor organizing, whether it be elections, and there's a bunch of, you know, kind of a wish list of sorts of what we're trying to achieve here. Now, in terms of post-Bernie, I mean, I think part of it's also DSA is trying to reinvent itself after, you know, after Bernie, and there's a lot of different groups internally in terms of trying to have their own vision. You know, some people are much more prioritizing electoral campaigns, which, you know, to be fair, is the most successful program that DSA has in terms of people knowing DSA. And so there's, people are focusing on trying to, you know, oh, we should be going all in on this. There are those who are trying to focus more on, say, abolitionist organizing, given what happened that last year. And there are those who are focusing, maybe we should be doing more tenant organizing. There's been some very successful tenant organizing in, you know, in the Bay Area, for instance. With some people who are focusing on, say, mutual aid, which are, you know, we need to be focusing on making sure our fellow workers are surviving and going on forward, first of all. So there is a multitude of different perspectives occurring right now in the DSA. And at this time, really what it is trying to identify what is our identity post-Bernie. But I will emphasize that I would point you to that national platform that DSA passed. It's on the website. It's like, if you go to dsausa.org, it's like, it's a, there should be a link to the national platform, and it has like a long list of all the things, and it's in beautiful this web design.
No, well, you know, I think it's also, it seems to me it's hard to sort of disaggregate post Bernie from COVID, at least in terms
100%.
Of like, it's a really, you know, just in the context of doing this show, I'm like, those things happened almost the same day.
Also George Floyd uprising, you know, all of that together.
Yes. But I wonder if like there were opportunities or if COVID provided opportunities the pandemic, obviously not COVID. If the pandemic and our responses to it provided opportunities exposed to certain, you know, aspects of that were not being met by the DSA. I mean, I feel like a lot of the labor, you know, actions that we've seen over the past, I don't know, 6 months, more, seven, you know, this year, basically 10 months, have been a function of COVID. That it people are realizing, like, A, this job sucks, or my boss sucks, or there's, you know, we're consistently understaffed, or whatever it is.
The great resigning, people calling it too, with like white collar jobs.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that happened where it was just, you know, people basically 55 and older. I think most of the statistics show that it was like in that age where people are just like, I don't want to work anymore because this sucks. And I'll try and, you know, if I can make it to retirement, early retirement or, you know, partial retirement, I'll do that. Was there stuff like from the perspective of the DSA that was capitalized on in this regard?
Yeah, it's complicated because, you know, despite DSA being the largest socialist organization in America, about 100,000 people, it still is limited in terms of how much we can do. America's gigantic. But, you know, there was a lot of, you know, when the pandemic originally hit, I know, for example, in New York City and also a lot of different places, there was mutual aid and also people trying to help in terms of giving food for especially the elderly, to try to, like, you know, delivering groceries and things like that. But, you know, in terms of labor organizing or things with COVID, I think, you know, in general, we could have done more. I'll be honest with you. That's how I feel. And here I am only speaking as myself, not as a representative of DSA. And to be honest, I think there's a lot we could be doing more. But I think this is just also part of what, kind of like what you were saying before in terms of what we need to do in terms of moving forward after Bernie, what our identity should look like. Because, you know, clearly, at least from my point of view, we should not just be solely focused on elections. We should be focusing in terms of what our thing, you know, with, like, you're pointing to, like, you know, all the strikes, you know, the Kellogg strike, or like the, you know, the Nabisco and what happened today with the John Deere kind of finalizing, and also all these different strikes that are happening. You know, there's like the UPS strike that's on the horizon. Like, it's going to happen. Like, the leadership is saying that in 2023, you know, they're hoping to be very trying to really face through a fight when their contract is up. You know, like, labor militancy is rising in this country. And, you know, DSA has played a part of it, but it's not played, you know, a central part of it. I think it has to do with what you're saying. This is kind of what we argue about, you know, myself and Jamie, in terms of, like, a lot of it has to do with, like, it is overdetermined in a sense of there are larger societal material forces at play than, say, individual people can really have, history is moving along. You know, people, you know, when, you know, COVID happened and then the pandemic and then and also with, like, the massive collapse of the economy, like, you know, very quickly when quarantine happened, and then also looming crisis that's kind of hanging over people's heads while wealth inequality is shooting up. You don't have to be approached by a socialist necessarily to be thinking, well, this is not right.
Yeah, right.
I mean, yeah. Like, we had a major uprising last year, and maybe the politics weren't as fully formed as some people might have liked them to be, but we had a mass of people, proletarians, multiracial proletarians, but led by Black and Brown youth, saying, this is fucked. It's bad. We're tired of watching people get killed. We're tired of going hungry. We're tired of seeing our relatives die of COVID, all of the things in one. And something I've really been thinking through is why the two great surges, the two great populist uprisings of the past 2 years came out in two different parts, by which I mean the Bernie campaign and the George Floyd uprising. And there were certainly some places where they overlapped, but I think perhaps the challenge for any socialist organization going forward is going to be to try to synthesize these things and grow together groups that are led by different fractions of the class. Because, you know, as you know, the typical DSA person is sort of a downwardly mobile white millennial, maybe white collar worker who went to college. Not all of them, obviously, but that is disproportionately true. Whereas the people who participated in the direct actions and the militant portions of the George Floyd uprising were largely more Black and brown proletarian youth. So I really think it is an essential task of any socialist or communist organization to figure out how to grow those things together.
Yeah, and I think another thing, just real quick, Sam, is just like, you know, it's on this last note, it's just, I think an important thing too that we should be mindful of, you know, and I have this in the front of my mind, you know, as someone who's Latino, it's like, I was talking to Jamie about this last night. A big factor is like, you know, people, like, and I mean this literally, I do not mean this metaphorically, people, there are many people who are, would be, they're ready or already on board with like a lot of what the left wants, even the most radical demands, but many organizers just literally do not speak the same language, as in like they do not speak, many people out there do not speak English or do not speak English well. And like, you know, a good example in terms of the evidence, look at like the massive amount of support by Latinos for Bernie in the primary. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with like, if you're trying to reach them to do other things, if how are they good? You know, I know for myself, you know, it's something like a criticism I have about DSA. And it, again, this has more to do with the demographics than it is about structurally. It's about, you know, my parents voted for Bernie in 2020. They're really on board with like a lot of the stuff I talk about, or Jamie argues, or DSA argues, but I can't bring them to a meeting because, you know, they feel out of place because they mostly speak Spanish.
Right. Well, to that end, we have an ambitious long-term project to make our podcast available in Espanol. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I'm saying it now, so I guess we have to do it.
Yeah, well, if everyone who is listening and is interested in making sure that happens long-term, be sure to subscribe to our Patreon on patreon.com/everybodylovescommunism.
Good job, Jorge.
Well done. Well done. All right, well, before we go, Jamie, do you want to talk about, you want to plug your other life?
Oh, yeah. So people may or may not know this about me, but I used to DJ and book a lot of shows and music and parties. And I've recently gotten back into it through my new boyfriend who runs a record label. And at first I was like, oh yeah, let me just DJ this. He asked me to DJ and I was like, all right, fine. I'm not like a real DJ. I don't jockey any discs. I don't like match beats, but I do have good dark wave playlists and I know how to use the CDJs now. And so I was like, yeah, okay, I'll DJ your party. Yeah, okay, I'll book a headliner. Yeah, also your t-shirts could use a little work. So I guess I'm a part of this record label now. It's called House of Feelings. And we have events like, we've been doing them like every month. It's crazy. We just had a crazy one at Elsewhere in Brooklyn, if you heard of that.
The musicians are fantastic. They're so talented. And I mean, seriously, you're so one of the singers, I think Andrew, he's such an incredible singer.
Thanks, man. I agree. He's the disco god. But our next event is actually tonight. Oh my God, it's tonight. I got to finish making my playlist at Wonderville right here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. So if anyone wants to come hang out with me after my set, I'm going really early. I think I'm DJing at like 8:45, but yeah, I'll be free to hang out after that. So come on down or follow House of Feelings on the internet, on the social media, to stay updated on what we are doing.
We will put links, obviously, to Everybody Loves Communism and to your party tonight in the YouTube description and the podcast description.
Hell yeah.
Do you mind if I plug something else, Sam?
No, not of course.
Okay. So I feel like I would be remiss as my responsibility, you know, as elected leadership in DSA, to say that, you know, this coming Monday, if you are in North Brooklyn, being like Williamsburg, Greenpoint, Bushwick, Bed-Stuy, and you want to go to a DSA event, look, well, there's great luck for you, because this Monday at 7 p.m. at the Mayday space, there's going to be a general meeting of North Brooklyn DSA. So be sure to come out. And if you want to know political education, that, yeah, North Brooklyn DSA does have political education. There will be a session on race and class, led by, the speaker will be Cheryl Rivera, who's like one of the founding editors of the magazine Lux, and was also an incredible organizer. I have much respect for her. This will be on a Tuesday as well at the Mayday space.
Great. All right, guys. Go ahead, Jamie.
Oh, I I feel like I should mention one more time, we're on fans.fm/everybodylovescommunism in addition to Patreon. And we just made a Patreon as well, but we love Fans FM. Kyle built this amazing platform for the Majority Report and for other leftist podcasts to use and spread the word. And he's so cool. He's doing it for all the right reasons. And they take way less of our money than Patreon does. And for that reason, we're charging people a little bit more on the Patreon than on the Fans. But, you know, you can pick the platform that you're most comfortable with.
You mean you're charging people less on the Fans?
Than yeah. Is that what I, what did I say?
Well,
you charge people more on Patreon.
Oh, right. That's not what I said. Oh my God.
No, it's the same thing. But I'm just the marketing. But the other thing is too, get a URL that directs to that. That's my thing.
Sam is like a Bitcoin guy, but about URL.
That's right. That's basically it. I can't believe, Jamie, you didn't pick that up from me. That's really hurts. Get the URL and forward it. It's $11.
All right. I'm writing it down. I'm writing it down right now.
All right. All right. We'll put all the links in the podcast. Jamie, it was great to see you again. Jorge, great to meet you. And good luck with the show. Everybody Loves Communism. Is that like a play on like Everybody Loves Raymond?
It's exactly what it is. In fact, the logo is also a play on it, too.
Mm-hmm. You know, I figure like Everybody Loves Raymond, right? That really funny show with Ray Romano. So, huh?
Have you ever watched that show?
No, I'm joking. I don't like it very much at all. But
I've never seen it.
I figure if we just swap out Raymond for communism, maybe people will be like, "Oh, I like that too."
It might work.
It might work. We will see. All right, guys, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, going to head into the fun half of the program. Remember, majoritylive.com. Just got to say that just because I was talking about the URL. Oh, well, you mean you don't have to go to the wilbur.com/majority-report-live show? That's correct. You just go to majoritylive.com. But what are you going to do when you do like a New York show or a Tahiti show or whatever? Well, just re-forward majoritylive.com. That's what I will do. Look at this. Can't believe. I feel like all my work about forwarding URLs.
Yeah. just hard to get enthusiastic about it, I guess.
Well, I don't know. I guess it just means
I remember Bitly back when Twitter was only 140 characters, and that was a necessity. But, you know. We don't even have a website for Left Reckoning or a Literary Hangover, so.
All right. Well, fair enough. You could still set up a URL and have it just go right to where you sign up on iTunes. Yeah, and we're going to need to reconnect you
because you're starting to... So if Sam is a...
Am I starting to fade?
Starting to shudder a little bit on the screen, so we might have to reconnect you in the break here.
Okay. We're going to take a break, folks, and... breaking news, Kyle Rittenhouse, not guilty on all counts. All counts. All right. We're going to take a break. Don't forget, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian Media Universe?
Yeah, we had a full show on Wednesday. Go watch that. William Shockey of Africa is a Country, talking about the death of William de Klerk and Fred William de Klerk, and who should be credited for ending apartheid. And also Jacob of the Valley Labor Report, talking about the Warrior Met coal strike and that stuff. So and also David Griscom and I are going to be going over, I think, a appearance of Whoopi Goldberg and Christopher Hitchens on Real Time with Bill Maher, or maybe it was Politically Incorrect, where Whoopi defends communism for patrons. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You nervous? You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands
up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.